Thanks for tuning in to the Rachel Zimmerman Show on KMOX. I am really excited to bring you this week's episode. From the moment I first heard Jeff Smith's story, I was hooked. Here's a guy who had everything going for him, who made a mistake, and who ended up paying a very dear price. Jeff spent a year and a day in prison after pleading guilty to two felony counts of conspiracy to obstruct justice. I know, it sounds worse than the situation actually was, which we'll explore in this interview. We talk about his story, his life in politics, his time in prison, and what needs to change in our prison system. I think you'll really enjoy this interview, and if you want to learn more, Jeff wrote a book chronicling his experience. It's called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, and you can find it on Amazon. Okay, let's get started. So I want to start by talking about you growing up in St. Louis, playing basketball. How did that shape you?
That's a great question. So how did it shape me? Well, my dad had this dream, you know, that I was going to be like a basketball star, maybe make it to the NBA or something. The only problem is that he's 5'6" and my mom's 5'2", so that probably wasn't in the cards. They took me to the doctor when I was like 3 or something, and the doctor was like, "Well, the good news is he's healthy, but the bad news is he's in the third percentile in height and weight." And one of them was like, "Well, at least he's not in the first or second percentile." And the doctor was like, "There's actually no such thing. We started at 3." So, but my dad was pretty into this idea, and I loved basketball like more than anything. I mean, I loved all sports, but especially basketball. And he got me, you know, on a team where I was playing down. I grew up in Olivet, like just kind of west, a little bit west of the Loop, kind of where Del Mar ends. And then I ended up getting on this team where I was playing down at like Matthews Dickey and, you know, other places in on the north side when I was a kid. And that kind of, you know, was the first thing that helped me understand just the huge inequalities in this region, right? Because, you know, I grew up in just a very nice middle class area, you know, well-kept yards and pretty houses, not huge, but, you know, nice size, comfortable, you know, homes. And we'd be, you know, in certain neighborhoods where my games or, you know, practices were, where I played pickup. And, you know, I'd ask my parents, starting when I was like, you know, 10 years old, like, why does it look like this down here? Why is there trash on the street? Why is there broken glass everywhere? Why do the houses, you know, look like they're falling apart? It didn't just seem right to me that some people lived so differently than other people lived. I ended up, you know, I went to high school at a county school that accepted kids through the school DSEG program. And by my senior year, you know, I was the starting point guard on the team. And the other starters were all guys who came out through the DSEG program. And one of them asked me something that has stuck with me for 35 years. He said, "You know, everybody out here," he said, "do you think that I'm stupid?" And I was like, "No, I don't think you're stupid." He said, "I know everybody out here thinks that we're all stupid because we're in the low track of classes." And I was like, "Well, I don't think that." And he's like, "What people don't understand is that everything you guys are doing out here, when I got out here, it was like 4 years ahead of the stuff I was doing, you know, at my city school." And that stuck with me. It made me want to understand kind of the root causes of the inequities in the region. I went to the University of North Carolina and I majored in Black history to kind of wanting to understand this on a more national and even international perspective. And, you know, that ended up shaping so much of what happened in the rest of my life. You know, I came back to St. Louis, worked in St. Louis Public Schools, ended up co-founding a small charter school in North St. Louis, and which became 4 schools. And then ultimately getting my doctorate and running for office, a doctorate in political science, and then running for office. But my whole kind of interest in, you know, social justice and in kind of civic life and thinking that if you run for office, you can help fix some of these problems was really forged by those early experiences.
Did you ever get any pushback for that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I certainly got pushback when I'd, you know, be the only white kid in playing pickup on playgrounds in North St. Louis. And I had a moment when I was in the first class that was just for Black Studies majors, when the professor handed out the syllabus and asked if anyone had questions. And this woman was like, well, I have a question, you know, it's for him. Like, are you in the wrong class? And I was like, no. And the professor's like, you know, you can answer the question, you know, you can, I want you guys to talk, you know, and encourage me to respond. And I said, look, you know, I'm here because I want to, I think it's hard to really get anywhere in society if you don't learn about the other person or the other group's, you know, background and what is important to them. And so I think if we're going to, and this was like right before the OJ trial. So it's right before all this stuff broke open in America. And my perspective was just like, if some people don't try to learn more about the group on the other side of the divide, then there's not going to be anybody who's able to ever act as a bridge between the two sides. And so I said, that's why I'm here. And no, I'm not in the wrong class.
Is that why you got into politics, to be a bridge, kind of?
You know, that's sort of why I got into politics. It's certainly how kind of like it ended up turning out. You know, I ran the state Senate district that I represented, really was, it was half of the city and the northern half, you know, but it came down that basically Grand, it was almost everything west of Grand. So it wasn't, when people think of the city cut in halves, they think of the north side and the south side. But my district was the west side, the western half of the whole city. So I had a little more than half of North St. Louis and about a little bit less than half of South St. Louis. And being in a district that was, you know, a slight majority Black, but near 50-50, really was kind of an object lesson in trying to become a bridge between the two parts of the city. And the thing that I learned most about the city is that people on both sides, even though when we conceptualize the city's socio-political divides, we think of them as very different, it was actually uncanny how similar the things I heard knocking on doors on the north side were to things I heard on the south side, because everybody wanted safer streets, everybody was concerned about public safety, and everybody wanted better schools, you know, better public schools, you know, in particular, to send their kids to. That was the number one and number two issue in like every neighborhood I knocked in. And, you know, I'm not, you know, there's a lot of people that have accomplished more in politics than I have. There's certainly people that have had longer, you know, more enduring success in their political careers than I have. But one thing that I think I've got over anybody alive in Missouri politics is I think I've knocked on more doors than anybody. I just hit 90,000 doors that I've knocked on since 2002. And so I think that gives me a decent feel for how people think in different parts of the city and different parts of the region. And that was what jumped out at me, is just how much more we had in common than we often realize, based on, in part, the way that the media tends to portray, you know, people in different parts of the region.
Welcome back to the Rachel Zimmerman Show. Let's get back to our interview with former Missouri Senator Jeff Smith. So you just described the part of the city that you served whenever you were in the Missouri Senate. Before that, you ran for Congress. I want you to tell me and my listeners about the postcard and how that got you into trouble.
Yeah, yeah. So that congressional race was where I met your buddy, Dave Glover, and went on his show for the first time back then. And you know, you talked about working to be a bridge. And one thing I learned when I started that race is, you know, I needed to go on all kinds of talk shows because nobody had any idea who the hell I was. And I was running against Russ Carnahan, right? And so everybody knew that name. So I came on, you know, with conservative hosts like Dave and found that there were lots of issues that, you know, we actually agreed on. Things like the national debt and, you know, getting that under control. And so we didn't just, you know, continue this, you know, deficit spending in a way that would cripple the ability of future generations to, you know, benefit from government support. In that first race, I was desperate. Desperate to get my name out there, desperate to raise money, desperate to alert people to differences between my background and Russ Carnahan's background, because I think there was a meaningful difference in terms of, you know, just our work ethic and our just energy level, you know. And there was some information about his attendance record in the state legislature showing that he had one of the worst records of showing up for work out of anybody. And my press secretary would shop that to reporter after reporter after reporter, and they weren't covering it. Every quarter, they would write the same story. When the fundraising reports came in, they would say, Russ Carnahan has a huge fundraising lead. He's raised almost $1 million. He's 35 points ahead in the polls, and he's got universal name ID and almost all the important endorsements. How can he lose? And that got really frustrating to me because I wanted them to cover, here's a difference between Smith and Carnahan on the Iraq war. Here's the difference between Smith and Carnahan on, you know, some, you know, a social issue. Here's the difference between them on showing up for work, right? And then about 3 weeks before Election Day, this consultant comes to talk to two of my aides, and he says, I want to get the information about Carnahan's missed votes, his poor attendance record. And my aide came to me and said, should I give him the information? And I had a couple choices in that moment. I could have said, no, don't give him the information. I could have said, look into his background a little bit before you do anything. Or I could have done what I did, which was say, don't tell me any details. I don't want to know what you do. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, are you stupid? Like, don't tell me anything. And I walked away. So the whole exchange lasted less than a minute, but it was probably the most important minute of my life in terms of how consequential it was on the direction of the rest of my life, because my aide did exactly what I wanted him to do, which was he got the information off the website and printed it out and handed it to this consultant. This consultant put out a postcard. It was like the size of an index card, 3x5, costs like several thousand dollars to mail it to, you know, people in the district. It got lost in the deluge of mail over the last couple weeks of a campaign. And then, you know, but right before it came out, I stood on the steps of the old courthouse alongside another of our primary opponents, and I said, Russ Carnahan's a nice and decent man from a wonderful family with a proud tradition of public service, but he doesn't go to work very much. And here's the statistics on that. Because I was so, I didn't think anything was ever going to happen after my aide had told me, you know, I had said, don't tell me anything, and we didn't hear anything else about it. So I just called a press conference and I just said it. And then like the next day, this little postcard starts hitting mailboxes that's got all the information that I had just said to the TV cameras the day before. But the postcard lacked the requisite paid for by disclaimer at the bottom. And that opened it up to a complaint with the Federal Election Commission that Carnahan filed in the last days of the campaign. Election night was chaotic. I was winning most of the night. I won St. Louis City easily. I won St. Louis County, but I lost in the rural areas in Jefferson County and St. Genevieve. And Jefferson County was more rural then than it is today. And I lost in the deep southern part of the district. The final votes came in around 5 a.m. And when I woke up, I had lost. Even though when I went to sleep, you know, I still had a good chance. A couple days later, I went in to see Carnahan. I told him I'll support you in the general election. I'll do whatever I can to help you. But could you please drop that complaint you filed with the Federal Election Commission? Because I knew that something was fishy about the way we did it. I didn't know the details. But the reason that I had told my staff, don't tell me anything, is because I knew that what we had done wasn't exactly kosher. You can't coordinate with a third party, you know, entity, because it can circumvent our campaign finance laws. His brother said that the missile had already left the silo on the ethics complaint, and that was that until a few weeks later when the Federal Election Commission asked me some questions in writing. My lawyer prepared an affidavit. It had 15 statements, 14 of which were true. But the one that wasn't said, I do not know who financed, designed, printed, produced, or disseminated the postcard. I signed the affidavit. Then I went to go teach political science at Dartmouth College. I was figuring, I'm moving. I'm done with all this. But I came back a couple of years later. I ran for the state Senate. I won. And then I was in a position to maybe run against Carnahan, who was sitting in Congress. And then the complaint started coming back again. And then ultimately, when I was the day that I was announcing for my reelection to the state Senate, the feds knocked on my door that morning around 6:30 a.m. And they started asking questions about that postcard from 5 years earlier. And instead of just owning up to everything, I said, I don't really know what you're talking about. Called my lawyer, and my lawyer called the prosecutor, and the prosecutor's office said, guess what? His best friend has been wearing a wire for the last couple months, so we've already got him. Then I had to make a decision about the so-called cooperation, basically like whether you're going to wear wire on other people who are higher up on the food chain than you. And it seemed like a fishing expedition to me to do that to people who were friends, you know, who I trusted, who I didn't think the feds had anything concrete on, even though in their mind, you know, they thought they did. But I knew they were wrong because I knew the things they were theorizing about enough to know that they had no idea what they were talking about, and they were just trying to get somebody the biggest scalp they could. And I didn't want to. I just, the feeling you get after your best friend does it to you, it doesn't make you want to go do that to somebody else to save your own skin. So I pled guilty and was sentenced to a year and a day in federal prison in Southeast Kentucky.
When we come back, more with Jeff Smith on the Rachel Zimmerman Show on KMOX. And we're back with Jeff Smith on the Rachel Zimmerman Show on KMOX.
Before we move on, how often do you think stuff like that happens, like with the postcard? I mean, I'm assuming you thought, oh, I'll get away with this. People get away with stuff like this all the time.
I mean, I'm not trying to say this in a way that justifies what I did because I screwed up. But in the time since you and I started this interview, a candidate for office has illegally coordinated with a third party group. Mm-hmm. You know, like it happens all the time.
And do you feel like your sentence was above and beyond because of what you did and who you are?
So look, I don't think that if as a taxpayer, you know, I wouldn't want to spend my tax money putting someone like me, having done what I did in to pay for them to be in prison. And that's kind of the feedback that I get from a lot of other people. I'm not saying I shouldn't have been punished. Because I should have been punished. But what I think we suggested to the court would have been a better use of taxpayer money and I think a more appropriate punishment, which was resignation from office, having a felony conviction to not ever be able to run for office again for the state legislature, and 2 years of home confinement where I would have taught civics in a St. Louis, you know, in a public school in St. Louis City. For free and coach basketball and then come home and been confined in my house other than going to work every day instead of costing taxpayers tens of thousands of dollars for that year. I could have saved taxpayers, you know, six figures by doing that for free for a couple of years. So and basically having this huge lesson that I had just learned about how my whole career had been ruined over my mistakes. So I thought that would have been a better use of money, to be honest with you. That wasn't how things worked out. And when you choose, when the government is trying to get you to, you know, help them in their broader theories to prosecute other people, and you don't do it in the way they want you to do it, you typically pay the price. And I paid the price when the prosecutor called what I did a textbook case of political corruption, as if I had profited from it, you know, which I hadn't. And of course, I'd lost the race anyway. And requested like a much higher sentence, which I didn't get the maximum sentence, but you know, so I was sentenced to a year and a day, which was actually the second shortest sentence out of like 2,500 people who were in Manchester, Kentucky, doing federal time at that point. Almost everybody had, you know, 10 plus years.
Hmm. Where were you at emotionally heading into prison?
You know, I've always been somebody who is pretty forward looking. I've always been somebody who, you know, instead of dwelling on, you know, oh, I should have done this, or damn him, how could he do this to me? I spent most of my time looking forward and being like, how am I going to get through this? And what am I going to do when I come out? And when I got there, you know, I had an interesting interaction right when I got there. And a couple interesting interactions that stuck with me. You know, I got there and went into the intake, and the, you know, the woman, middle-aged woman, she, you know, we're in Appalachia, and she's like, you know, hot and weight. And I said, 5'6", 120. And she said, education level. I said, PhD. And she said, last profession. I said, state senator. And she was like, well, all right. You want to play games? You can play games all you want. We got ones in here think they're Jesus Christ. And then I went to my cell, and they had me with a few other guys, and they were all curious about me. and they're like, you know, this guy's like, what you done did? And I was like, I lied to the feds. And he's like, how'd they get you? And I was like, well, my best friend wore a wire. And he's like, damn. He need to get chalked, like, you know, the lines of chalk around her body. And I was like, well, I'd never heard it put quite like that. And then he said, how long you got? And I said, a year and a day. And he said, damn, he said, I done more time in this joint on the toilet than you got time.
That's pretty good.
25 years, you know, was his total time of adult incarceration. And, you know, I heard things like that, whether it was from staff, you know, during intake, or, you know, fellow prisoners. And I just thought, I got to write this stuff down. And I started jotting stuff down on toilet paper, sometimes on napkins that I took from the chow hall. And those notes, then put them onto little spiral notebooks, and then sent them back. And my former staffer and friend Kaylee Berger, she transcribed it, and that became a book called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison. So I've always, even while I was there, and I worked on the loading dock in the warehouse, unloading, you know, 80-pound boxes of meat and 100-pound bags of rice, flour, sugar, from, you know, to putting them in freezers or putting them in storage. So that was my day job. But when I got home at night, I would jot down those notes. And I've always kind of been somebody that thought, well, maybe things aren't great right now, but what am I going to do today to make things better tomorrow? And that book ended up, you know, doing well and leading to all kinds of other opportunities for me to help influence public policy around criminal justice issues in Missouri and around the country. And that's been a real blessing, because when I got out, after some of the things that I saw in prison, I determined that some part of my life, for the rest of my life, was going to be involved in helping reduce mass incarceration and helping make our criminal justice system more humane and more rehabilitative, so that people aren't going back and back and back again and again through this revolving door that characterizes much of our prison and jail system.
So in your book, you talk about the deliberate waste of human potential. I'm really interested in that, and I'm really interested in the deliberate part.
So when I say deliberate waste of human potential, I mean that where I was locked up, there were almost no opportunities for people to better themselves, or do anything that would make it less likely that they would go back to prison. Let me back up on that. I met some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life in prison. They had incredible business minds. They had all been successful business people on the outside. The thing they were selling wasn't legal, but 99% of the people I was locked up with were there for selling drugs. And they got in the federal system as opposed to local or state because they were moving large quantities of drugs. So they were pretty, you know, generally middle to high on the food chain and had long sentences. But there wasn't a single concept that you could learn at Olin Business School at WashU that I didn't hear explained while I was locked up, whether it was new product launch, promotional incentives, supply chain management, territorial expansion, barriers to entry. I heard all this stuff explained in the parlance of the drug trade. And it made me think, God, if there were some mechanism to help these guys translate their intuitive grasp of the business world into something legal, they could be really successful when they come home. So that saddened me because there were almost no educational opportunities. The whole time I was there, there was one GED course which was run and I applied to teach it. I had, you know, over a decade of teaching experience, but they wouldn't let me teach it. You know, instead I was in the warehouse. I'm not saying that to be like, woe is me. It's not about, you know, my martyrdom. It's about, you know, the person they had teaching was the person who passed the GED course the last year, and now they want to, you know, so, right. You know, I might have been able to bring more, you know, to the table. The other course they offered was a hydroponics course on how to grow tomatoes in water, which I understood the purpose for when one of the CEOs who led it came and backed up his truck so that we could all carry the tomatoes we grew into his truck. So presumably he could eat them or sell them by the side of the road.
Wow.
And then the third course, and this is when I say deliberate waste of human potential. The third course was a computer skills course. And I was excited for this because there was a computer room with 12 computers that was locked the whole time I was there. And then a few weeks before my release, they called a dozen of us down to the education area. They told us to go and sit down in front of the computers. And the CEO is like, all right, you see that little button on the bottom right? Push that button. That's going to turn your computer on. So we push the button, the computer comes on, we sit there, and one of the other prisoners is moving the mouse in a circle and watching the arrow on the screen go in a circle that corresponds to the motion of his hand, and he's fascinated by it, right? Because this is 2010, and they'd all been locked up for, you know, 10, 20 years, and this guy had never been on a computer like most of the people in that room, and he was fascinated by how the arrow moved when he moved the mouse. And he said, CO, you know, when I move my hand, and the CO says, shut the fuck up. We sat in silence for 45 minutes. And at the end of the 45 minutes where we weren't allowed to do anything on the computer, the CO says, y'all remember that little button on the bottom right? We'll push it again and get back to your cell. The 1 hour of that 1 year that I was there, that prison wanted, you know, had a moment where people could have at least learned how to point and click and look for a job when they came home. And they didn't even take advantage of that. And the CO took pleasure, a perverse pleasure, you know, in doing that. Now, I'm not saying all prisons are like that, because the head of the Department of Corrections in Missouri, Ann Preisseith, and her deputy, Matt Sturm, do a heck of a job trying to bring more programming into some of our state prisons. They've brought Launch Code in. A nonprofit that I help that does second chance employment brings people in to help make video job resumes for people who are leaving. The St. Louis County Jail under Scott Anders and Doug Burris has brought college courses and other opportunities in. But when I was there almost 15 years ago at that prison, it was a disgrace. And that's what motivated me to want to get involved in trying to help people realize their untapped potential and really help employers in the world tap this previously, you know, unrecognized pool of talent.
You talk about the CEOs in your book. It doesn't seem like it's a great relationship. And you also talk about how it's the prisoners versus the prison. I'm still getting that vibe from you now.
Yeah, I mean, look, you go into prison, there's only two teams, you know, there's you guys and there's the COs. And yeah, there were COs that tried to buddy up to me. They'd be like, hey, you know, Senator, you know, tell me about what it's like being a big time politician or whatever. But like, you can't have that conversation. You can't be seen like, you know, hanging out and chopping it up with the COs, because then people are going to think you're a snitch. And the next time somebody goes down for something, And it's the CEO who busts them is the one that you were talking to on the yard 2 days ago. Then that word gets out that, oh, yeah, I remember that when they were, you know, and like, then you're done. So you got to be careful. And, you know, you when you're locked up, especially if you're somebody that comes in as a, you know, I was one of like, you know, you could count on two hands, probably the number of white collar people, you know, in the whole place. And I didn't have like a crew to back me up. I ended up getting to know the guys that I worked with on the warehouse loading dock, and they ultimately, you know, became friends and people who looked out for me in some key times where I could have been, you know, in some danger. But hey, when you get in there, you know, you can't buddy up to the prison staff.
When we come back, the final part of our interview with former Missouri Senator Jeff Smith on KMOX. Welcome back to the Rachel Zimmerman Show. Now the final part of our interview with former Missouri Senator Jeff Smith.
When you left prison, I'm going to assume you had more resources than the average convict. What is the average ex-con's options whenever they're leaving?
Look, I had advantages that 99.9% of people who leave prison in this country are never going to have, right? You know, I had a doctoral degree from a great university, WashU. I had a family that they were frustrated with me, but they still stood by me. I had a physical home to go home to. I'm white. In so many ways, I was advantaged compared to most people who leave prison in this country, but I had a hard time finding a decent job. And when I interviewed at a small nonprofit, the vice chair of the board said to me at the end of the interview, you've got everything we're looking for, but why shouldn't we hire someone else, let you go work somewhere else, and then just hire you away from them in like a year once the aroma has started to wear off? If that's the kind of question that I got, imagine what it's like for most people who come out of prison, have this mark on their record that makes it much harder to get a job with 90% of employers performing criminal background checks, much harder to find a place to live, 85% of landlords in this country running criminal background checks. And most landlords and employers won't consider people, you know, that have felony convictions, especially certain types. So there are huge obstacles in addition to thousands more regulations that constrain the freedom of people coming out of prison in this country. And that's why, you know, one of the things that I work on now is recruiting companies to hire people who have recently come out of prison, finding good connections and trying to work with this nonprofit called the Transformative Workforce Academy based out of SLU that works, acts as the eHarmony for second chance employment, helping get people into jobs that they can succeed in, that they like, that they want to go to, and that are aligned with their career goals so that we're not just shunting people who come out of prison into the worst jobs that nobody wants, but actually helping give them a chance to flourish and be happy. That'll be good for them and their families, where they can be involved in their kids' lives or their families' lives. It'll be good for the companies in an environment of, you know, 3-4% unemployment where they're, you know, always looking for new talent pools. And it'll be great for this whole region and this whole state where public safety is such a challenge, because the number one thing that influences whether or not someone's going to go back to prison when they come out is whether they can land a full-time job in the first several months home. So if you're listening to this right now and you don't really care about these issues, do you ever come to a Cardinals game? Do you like to go downtown? Do you want to feel safe anywhere in this region? Well, the best way to do it is if we can help people who have been justice involved in the past, reassimilate into the economic fabric, into the mainstream of this community, where they won't feel estranged, they won't be impoverished, they won't feel alienated enough to bust into your car or hold someone up, stick someone up. Instead, they'll be working and spending time with their family and have the chance to thrive in the same way that we all want for ourselves and our children.
What's the biggest thing you wish everyone would realize about the prison system that you think we're just not getting?
It's a great question. Probably that there is a different way to do prison. And they do prison very differently in most of other industrialized democracies in Europe. And the recidivism rate in most of those countries is like in the teens. The recidivism rate in the United States is closer to like 75%. So people in the United States who leave correctional facilities are about five times as likely as people in Denmark or Norway to go back to prison. And that costs every one of us money, like $80, $85 billion nationally. You know, we spend, you know, at the federal level, and we don't do very, it's not a very good investment. If three out of four people coming home are going right back, we're paying for them again and again and again. If we did our prisons in a less dehumanizing way, like in some of the countries that I mentioned before, where it's, when you go in, you don't get stripped of your clothes and given a uniform. You don't get stripped of your name and given a number. You don't get stripped of your dignity every day of your time there. Instead, you get diagnosed with, if you have mental health challenges, quickly. You get provided therapy. You get retrained in a skill where there's jobs in the community to which you'll return, and then matched with, you know, employers. Those are the things that keep people from going back. Those are the things that some state and local prison systems in the United States are tentatively starting to do, but we need to transform the culture of corrections in the United States to do more of that. That's how we'll reduce recidivism. That's how we'll help repair families and communities. And that's how we'll foster public safety in regions like St. Louis, where it probably is the main thing holding us back.
Well, Jeff, thanks for sitting down with me today. I always love hearing your story. I love hearing your passion, and I just appreciate it so much.
Rachel, congrats on the new show.
Thank you.
Great to be here with you.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you to Jeff Smith. I really appreciate his candor in this interview. I thought it was great. If you missed any part of the conversation, go to the Odyssey app and download the Rachel Zimmerman Show podcast. You can also find that anywhere else you get your podcast. Just search for the Rachel Zimmerman Show. I really appreciate everyone who listens, and I hope you have a great weekend.